during the Bush administration. As FBI director under President Obama, I had come to know his chief of staff best. Dennis McDonough was an extraordinarily decent, thoughtful, and yet tough person. All chiefs of staff differ, as all people do, in their personalities and leadership qualities, but they all share the experience of prolonged sleep deprivation as they try to manage the effective operation of the White House and bring some order to what could be, at the best of times, a chaotic enterprise. No president in our history, of course, came close to Donald Trump, who brought his own skills and challenges and a unique brand of chaos. I did not know Priebus well. He often seemed confused and irritated, and it was not hard to imagine why. Running the Trump White House would be a difficult job for even an experienced manager, which Priebus wasn't. Previously chairman of the Republican National Committee, and before that a Wisconsin lawyer, Priebus had never served in the federal government. How could someone like that, or anyone for that matter, manage someone like Donald Trump? I have no idea, but Priebus seemed to be trying. Our meeting lasted about 20 minutes, was pleasant, and covered a variety of classified topics, as well as how the FBI and the Department of Justice should interact with the White House. As we were winding up, he asked me if I wanted to see the president. Ironically, the request perfectly undercut the entire point of our meeting. I had just finished discussing the importance of the White House working in a disciplined fashion through the Department of Justice if it wished to communicate with the FBI, except about national security emergencies and National Security Council policy discussions, like encryption, in which the FBI was a key participant. The theme of the conversation was that the FBI must be at arm's length. Priebus said he understood, and then he immediately wanted to bring me even closer. After my last encounters, another visit with the president was not high on my priority list. So I said no, thanks but no thanks, adding that I was sure the president was too busy. He asked again. I demurred again. He then said, "Sit. I'm sure he'd love to see you. Let me see if he's in the Oval." He walked down the hall, the short distance to the Oval Office, and returned moments later. With a smile, he said, "He'd love to see you." Without a smile, I replied, "Great." When the two of us walked into the Oval Office, the president was talking with White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer, who left shortly after we arrived, leaving Priebus and me with the president alone. Though this was not the first time I'd seen the new president, it was the first time I had seen him in his new office. He didn't look comfortable. He was sitting, suit jacket on, close against the famous Resolute desk, both forearms on the desk. As a result, he was separated from everyone who spoke to him by a large block of wood. In dozens of meetings in that space with Presidents Bush and Obama, I can't recall ever seeing them stationed at their desk. They instead sat in an armchair by the fireplace and held meetings in a more open, casual arrangement. That made sense to me. As hard as it is to get people to relax and open up with a president, the chances are much better in the sitting area, where we can pretend we are friends, gathered around a coffee table. There, the president can try to be one of a group and draw the others out to tell him the truth. But when the president sits on a throne, protected by a large wooden obstacle, as Trump routinely did in my interactions with him, the formality of the Oval Office is magnified, and the chances of getting the full truth plummet. I also noticed that President Trump had changed the curtains, which were now a bright gold. I later learned they were Bill Clinton's curtains, which, considering Trump's public views of the former president and his candidate wife, seemed an odd twist. The press reported that President Trump later replaced the Clinton curtains with his own version of gold. As the president greeted me, I sat down in a small wood chair, my knees touching his desk. Priebus tried to steer the conversation to the subject of the so-called Russian dossier that we'd already discussed numerous times. I'm not sure why he did that, but for once the president wasn't interested in discussing that particular topic. Instead, sitting at the desk once used by Presidents Kennedy and Reagan, he launched into one of his rapid-fire stream-of-consciousness monologues. This time, the focus was on a television interview he'd given to Bill O'Reilly on Fox News several days earlier. The interview had run during the Super Bowl pregame show, which I had skipped, but I saw plenty of commentary about it afterward. During the interview, O'Reilly had pressed President Trump as to whether he respected Russian President Vladimir Putin. "I do respect him," Trump said, "but I respect a lot of people. That doesn't mean I'm going to get along with him." But he's a killer, O'Reilly said. Putin's a killer. There are a lot of killers. We've got a lot of killers, Trump replied. What do you think? Our country's so innocent? Trump's answer, seeming to equate Putin's thuggish regime with American democracy, led to a flurry of criticism from all sides. It also played into a narrative that Trump was too close to the Russian government, an odd line for Trump to encourage. I had often wondered why, when given numerous opportunities to condemn the Russian government's invasions of its neighbors and repression, even murder of its own citizens, Trump refused to just state the plain facts. Maybe it was a contrarian streak, or maybe it was something more complicated that explained his constant equivocation and apologies for Vladimir Putin. Still, it struck me as odd. Perhaps there was some sound geopolitical rationale for not publicly condemning bad behavior of a foreign government in its own internal matters. But 4 weeks earlier, at Trump Tower, the president had seemed untroubled when the leaders of the intelligence community unanimously briefed him that Russia had intervened to damage our democracy and had tried to tip the scales of our election. Even behind closed doors, he didn't recoil about Russian behavior. He didn't wonder what our adversary might do next. We knew that Vladimir Putin had interfered with the U.S. election in an unprecedented fashion, at least in part to help Trump win. Comments like the one to O'Reilly only underscored why Putin wanted him in office. In his own blustery way, O'Reilly had challenged the president on his apparent affinity for Putin. And again, Trump had doubled down on his unwillingness to criticize the Russian government. Now, 3 days later, seemingly stung or at least preoccupied by the criticism, the president was still fuming and justifying himself. What am I going to do? Trump asked no one in particular. Say I don't respect the leader of a major country I'm trying to get along with? At first, neither Priebus nor I said anything. We couldn't, even if we'd wanted to, because as was his practice, President Trump left no space for others to talk. O'Reilly had posed a hard question, he told us. So I gave a good answer, he said, looking at us, all but insisting that there was no other rational way to see it. Really, it was a great answer. I gave a really great answer. As Trump kept talking, I could see he was convincing himself of this storyline, and clearly thought he was convincing us too. Of course, I didn't think O'Reilly's question was hard, or Trump's answer good, but this wasn't about him seeking feedback. In fact, by this point, I had dealt with the president enough to have something of a read on what Trump was doing. His assertions about what everyone thinks and what is obviously true wash over you, unchallenged, as they did at our dinner, because he never stops talking. As a result, Trump pulls all those present into